think that maybe she had taken the step, not by taking it, but because she had refused to take it. That was how she had learned things she wouldn't have learned by going all the way, though the natural motion she had ought to have taken her all the way. Likewise, she would always refuse to talk to me about it, and I participated in the same refusal by not questioning her. And yet I felt that if I managed to find an occasion to question her, she would answer me immediately in the frankest way. Everything, therefore, depended on me, on the question. Nevertheless, to realize how difficult it would be for me to come to that, I had only to recall the night she had remained at such a distance from me, a distance which really seemed to lay down on her the reserve which it wasn't enough for me simply to push away now, which, on the contrary, I had to leave intact, sensing that this was the only place we could henceforth reach, each without reserve and talk to each other without lying. In this sort of interval, I was sure she would not hide anything from me, but only to the extent that I, too, by a difficult agreement, would enter it. Would I ever consent to stop pressing her and searching for her? Certainly, I could often reproach myself for the way I had continued to pester her, even in her sleep, and even in the calm with which she protected herself. I could sense the element of hopelessness in the sudden horror that she had made her leap out of that moment of the night in which I had touched her. Every time I went back over it, I kept finding in myself the wonderful nature of that movement, my sensation of joy in recapturing her, of luminousness in embracing her disorder, feeling her tears, and that her dream body had not been an image, but an intimacy overwhelmed by sobs. A moment so real that it consoled one for everything and exceeded all hope, all sadness, and all thought. That was what I would always remember, as I would recall all the moments we spent together in my room. She would remain on the balcony for hours, lying down, drawing rather childish landscapes or exclusively female figures related to her by a vague resemblance. Her sister, she would say. Or at other times, "What am I to you?" She wasn't surprised to see me watching her constantly, without any other concern, but without any insistence either. She said my look had little weight, that it made the things around her lighter. "It is as though you were alone." "No. Is it as though I were alone?" "Not that either. Maybe it's your look that is alone." She rarely lifted her head, there on the other side of the window pane, wrapped in blankets, while she drew the lines with a hand that moved almost constantly. Her essence then seemed to me not childish, but so divorced from thoughts of the future, so present, and yet so scarcely burdened by the present, so gravely, knowingly insouciant, that I could only look at her with a certain drunkenness. And it was no doubt this that gave her, in turn, the feeling of lightness that made her almost drunk too. Yes, in the long run, she was somehow abandoned to a spirit of lightness she wasn't always sure she could control. "And yet you're calm." "Yes, I'm calm, but it's already almost like a memory, the most distant of memory." "It's already in the past." "Yes, maybe it's in the past." But with her inevitable concern for exactness, she took care to add, "That point is still there, that extremely fine sort of point which forces us to retreat, to go back into the heart of the calm." "Us? Me too?" "Yes, us, only us." In fact, it sometimes happened that she couldn't stay where she was. She hastily tosses back the blankets, comes into the room, and in her haste, her fever keep her there, in some way motionless, until she finds a way out that leads her to me, but also to the other days, as though there had already been other days, back there in the past, in a space where people seem to walk more quickly, glide by, close together, more furtively. What place are they going to? Why such haste? Sometimes they separate and look at each other as though another memory lay between them, not a memory, forgetfulness, a torment that draws a circle around them and isolates them. She had always been afraid of dying outside of herself. She would say, "You have to hold me firmly. I must be struck at the point where you're holding me." At a certain moment, she had begun to want to recall something. She searched for it quietly, with a certain uneasiness, but also with great tact and firm patience. If she could have gotten up, she would have no doubt have gotten up to look for it in the room, all through the house, as though she were playing a game. Here? Here? Or here? No, nowhere near here. There was an allusion to that forgotten thing in everything she did, an allusion so discreet, so veiled that no one dared take notice of it. It happened a little in the background, behind her and behind him. Maybe it concerned both of them. When she died, she gave one the comforting, hopeless feeling that she was dying in order to remember it. Later, it was already the middle of the night. Without emerging from her immobility, she asked suddenly, "Am I the one who's dying, or is it you?" Words which he heard distinctly. He leaned over her, and she opened her eyes, looking at him with that serious, motionless, solitary look which, it seemed to him, she had now. It was like the reminder of a promise she was asking him to keep. As we were rising tranquilly, having left the drawing rooms, which were empty of people now, no other noise between us but the whistling of the pulley, as I listened to that noise, which I had noticed before, I thought that, with me, she was finishing the journey she had embarked upon a short time back. She would open the door of the elevator, walk along by my side, but a little behind, not completely level with me, leaving a gap of a few steps between us, as she could not help doing when she was on bad terms with me. It would be like that all the way down the famous corridor, a narrow corridor with door after door opening onto it, awash day and night with the same white light, without shadow, without perspective, and crowded, like a hospital corridor, with a ceaseless muffled din. All the doors were alike, all white, all the same white as the wall, indistinguishable from it, indistinguishable from one another except by the numbers on them. And as one walked down it, everything seemed equally sonorous, equally silent, as in a tunnel. Footsteps, voices, murmurs behind doors, sighs, happy slumbering and unhappy slumbering, fits of coughing, the whistling sounds of those who were having trouble breathing, and sometimes the silence of those who did not seem to be breathing anymore at all. I liked that corridor. I walked down it with a sense of its calm, deep, indifferent life, knowing that for me the future was there, and that I would have no other landscape than that clean, white solitude. That there my trees would grow, there would lie the immense rustling fields, the sea, the changing cloud-filled sky, there in that tunnel, the eternity of my encounters and my desires. Once we were standing before the door, having come to a stop without opening it, I was seized by what thought? By a thoughtless sadness, one that asked nothing, imposed nothing, could say nothing, could not be consoled, was merely empty and curtly separated us, as though she were at one end of the time and I at the other, but in the same instant and in a shared presence side by side. Did she understand that this was necessary? She gave the door a quick look, gave me a quick look too, and went off to her own room, which lay farther down at the bend in the corridor. If I think about it, what happened, I would have to say that for me it almost merges with a calm that allowed me to face it. This calm was a gripping sort of calm, very close to the word that came so far away. It wasn't completely commensurate with me. It was even extraordinarily outside of me, but that didn't bother me. I had my own share in it. It touched me. It even pushed me back slightly, as though to keep me on the edge of the moment when I would have to be calm. I applied my mind to it, and even though there was no real relation between us, I had the impression there was a space to which I felt bound by an expectation, by precautions, doubts, and intimacy, a solitude that would perhaps have been suitable for a living being. A human being? No, it wasn't human yet. It was more exposed, less protected, though more important and more real. But because that space was foreign to me, I did not know what bound me to it. I only knew that I owed it some respect, and I didn't even know that, because perhaps I also owed it a fierce lack of respect. In addition to that first impression, I always felt that the space, while appearing infinitely distant and foreign, offered me a sort of immediate means of access. It seemed to me that if I managed to be calm, to be equal to that calm, and to be in myself what that calm was outside me, I would remain in balance not only with all my thoughts, but with a motionless, grave, and solitary thought under whose cover my thoughts continued to express themselves so lightly. All I had to do was wait. But waiting, had I made the decisive moves? Did I have to be more lively in my study of that event, that very recent event by which I felt I was being watched, by means of which I was undoubtedly watching myself, looking after the calm that was confided to my negligence? And yet, as though despite myself, I was already enjoying this new state. I had never been so free. And except for that grave, motionless thought, my thoughts, too, were freer, lighter, almost too light, yielding me up to a spirit of lightness that threatened not to leave me at my own level for very long. If I had wanted to, I would have thought everything. But I had to be aware of precisely that, beware of the even more enticing impression that we thought everything, that every thought was ours. I won't say that the space was already clearly delimited, but it could have been. I felt that, and a doubt remained that it was delimited as soon as I entered it, at least might have been. The doubt weighed powerfully on each of my steps, not only to push me back, but also to make me go forward. If there hadn't been an uncertainty between it and me that protected both of us, if there hadn't been my weakness, its weakness, my weakness so superior to me, so decided and so sure, I wouldn't even have been able to be conscious of the thought that was vast enough to contain the two of us. But I did not doubt that kind of presence it constituted. As soon as I was there, I observed it. I experienced it. I leaned lightly on it, my forehead leaning on my forehead. And what held me back was something too easy in that approach, which left it without any defense and me without any decision. It was too simple. This easiness might have been what had deflected me for so long, one gesture and always within my reach. I could only be surprised at it and avoid it. Something warned me that the doubt should always be equal to the certainty, and the certainty of the same nature as the doubt. I had to wait, allow it to gain strength from that waiting, affirm itself in its contact with me and exhaust me with that calm. It had to find limits that were not too foreign to mine, nor too strict. It could close up again, but on me. Its instability was that suddenly scared me. And yet I dreaded just as much a distinctness that would have brought it too close to me. It would have frightened me more as a familiar thing than as a foreign thing. Everything was so calm that if it hadn't been for the soft, continuous pressure exerted on me, an extremely light and extremely firm pressure that I wasn't sure I wasn't exerting on it by my resistance and by the direction of my waiting, I could have believed I had already reached some goal. An ultimate one, perhaps one of the ultimate goals, and yet the calm also seemed to interpose itself between us, not as an obstacle, true, nor as a distance, but as a memory. A dangerous calm, I realized once again, and one that was in some sense of danger even to itself, threatened, threatening, yet unshakable, indestructible. It was final, a word which here appeared opaque. But light. It was dark. It was cold. The waiting, the calm made me feel that over there on one of the slopes which I could only situate over there was an opening into a different region, one that was even more useless and more hostile, and that we both dreaded in the same way. The space was evasive, wily, frightened. Maybe it had no center, which was why it disoriented me by its evasion, its wiliness, its temptation. It stole away. It kept stealing away, and yet not always. Abruptly, I had before me a hungry evidence, an ultimate avidity which I had to escape, as though it were drawn in me by the sense of that center which it didn't have, or by that calm that awaited me. A terrible feeling that immediately made me draw back. But I, too, became wily. I learned not to be content with it, not to return to myself. I never despaired. I tirelessly prowled around. I had lost every habit, every path. The only firm thing I had was the motionless thought that enveloped us and perhaps protected us. And yet, I had glimpsed some possibilities, recognized the places where everything became denser, more real. It was like a slope one had only to follow, a slope that started off from calm and ended in calm. On either side were shining images, an endless din. That din made me drunk, perhaps crazy. It seemed to me motionless, high, and smooth. It was a height that pushed me back down toward the bottom, a speech untouched by the silence. It was at once powerful and empty, authoritarian and docile. It was uttered far away from here, far away even from the space, and as though outside, over there in the useless region, and yet also in me. A feeling that at no price should I make use of the agitation of that speech, nor adhere to it. But I stayed on the crest of that narrow drunkenness, cramped against a phantom of lightness, controlling a feeling of pain, of joy, not controlling it. It was light, joyous, of an amazing lightness. It allowed itself to be seen rather than heard, a shining sphere, a sphere that merged with its surface, kept growing, and was calm as it grew. The agitation of a speech in no way confused, and when it falls silent, it does not fall silent. I could distinguish myself from it, only hear it while hearing myself in it, this immense speech which always said, we. The sort of drunkenness that sprang from it came from that we, which sprang from me, and which, far beyond the room where the space began to enclose itself, obliged me to hear myself in that chorus whose bass I situated over there, somewhere in the direction of the sea. That was where we all were, over there, erect in the solitude of our unity, and what we said ceaselessly praised what we were. What else is there now but us, no one? Who are the distant ones and who are the close ones? We here and we over there. And who are the oldest and who the youngest? We are. And who must be glorified? Who comes to us? Who waits for us? We must and we do. And the sun, where does it get its light from? From us and only us. And the sky, what exactly is it? The solitude that is in us. Then who must be loved? I. A mysterious answer, a strange murmur that disturbs us. The voice is weak, harsh, like a squeak of a lizard. Our own has the volume and strength of worlds added into worlds, but it is also silent. The other has something animal about it, too physical, almost imperceptible. It shakes us. Even though it may be a sort of ritual, hearing it is a disquieting, sublime surprise, a feeling of immense happiness. This is what I can't get rid of, what radiates eternally from these days, what began that first moment, what makes that first moment still continue, always continue. We remain together. We live turned toward ourselves as though toward a mountain lifting vertiginously from universe to universe. Never any stop to it, no limit, a drunkenness ever drunker and calmer. We. The word glorifies itself eternally, rises endlessly, passes between us like a shadow, lies under our eyelids like a gaze that has always seen everything. It is the shelter we hurry under, knowing nothing. Our eyes closed and our mouths are also closed. How we nevertheless see things, that strange sun, that terrible sky, this is what doesn't preoccupy us. insouciance is the gift we have been given. And from the first moment, it was already a very old thing. The feeling of that altitude, an immense column whose top and bottom merging put us within reach of an infinite growth. Yes, it always goes farther. It is always more indestructible, always more immobile. Eternity is achieved, but grows on. Such a discovery is accepted right away. No beginning, and yet the soar of a perpetual awakening. No end, but an aspiration always satisfied and always desiring. This thought scarcely weighs upon our shoulders. There is nothing solemn or grave about it. It is a lightness itself. It makes us laugh. That is our way of examining it. Frivolity is what is best about us. It unsettles us to praise ourselves for being frivolous, as though an unknown center were being touched in us. Sometimes the sky changes color. Already black, it becomes blacker. It increases by one tone, as though to show that the impenetrable has withdrawn still further. I could be afraid I am the only one to realize this. Everything, it claims, is common to us except the sky. Our share of solitude passes through this point. But it is also this share is the same for everyone, and we are all united within this point, even in our separation, united only here and not elsewhere. This would be the ultimate goal. What proves it is that every time that black becomes blacker by a nuance that can only be communicated within our very midst. What each of us then secretly says in order to give reality to that sign rises from all sides into one common cry that alone reveals to us what we have caused ourselves alone to hear. A terrible cry, apparently, always the same. What is terrible about it at its highest point does not change, and yet we know that it varies imperceptibly in response to the intangible variation of the sky. That is why it is terrible. We wouldn't tolerate the sky being a single point. This is probably the source of the thought that is laying down on me, that wraps me around and protects me like a veil. But if it weren't a point, if it weren't as infinitesimal as the sharpest needle point, how could I bear it? Do you mean the sky sinks into us like the point of a needle? Yes, that's it. That's right. This point would therefore be what pierces the most distant of my memories. The greatest calm reigns. It's a unique moment. Certainly here we are attaining something that was not hoped for, that comes unexpectedly, that happens the very moment we expected the opposite. One gets up if one was lying down. One freezes if one was running. Perhaps one was running away. Or, to put it better, one stops and bows one head as though to reflect. True, I don't remember this. Speech informs us about it. Image shows it to us. Memory does not encounter it. We move about uselessly behind ourselves. And yet, I remember many things, everything, maybe not that moment. And as soon as I move toward it more boldly, I run up against the extremely fine and amazingly distant point, that point we call the sky. That single changing point, ever blacker and sharper, which we find suddenly before us, and which is there only to urge us to withdraw, to go back inside the calm from which our lightness has also eternally made us go forth. What then would remove us from the calm? Why is this equilibrium once attained lost again as though forever? What is the source of the feeling we have that we must look after everyone around the moment of the calm, that cold moment whose memory is nevertheless strange to us? Why do we know that thing of which there is no knowledge? Imperceptibly, the question raises up, throws us upon one another, is our balance, the balance of a happy day. The happiness of always saying yes, of endlessly affirming. We have known other days. Back there in the past, it seems we walked more quickly. Close together, we glided more furtively. Toward what place? Why such haste? Sometimes we look at one another as though between us there were a memory, not a memory, forgetfulness, the touch of an instant, the hope that draws a circle and isolates us? Is it the past, the suddenly visible face? We knew those days. They don't belong to yesterday. They are eternally those that are coming, those that do not pass, and they are the joy, the brightness that comes from us, and they are the surprise of having breached the wall, and without error or doubt, going by every road joyously toward ourselves. Why should all that have changed? Why should what had been said, the eternal, cease to be? But nothing has changed. It's only that you also have to know eternity in the past. You have to raise yourself high enough to be able to say, that was. Such is the mission now reserved for you. I don't believe in that speech, but I don't have the power to avoid it either. It is as though I had to hear it in the past too, and feel that not to believe is to fall more quickly than it is falling down the slope it has already dug. Spirit of lightness, it must not be betrayed. It is when one moves away from it that the feeling of constant thought turns into the feeling of an unmoving surveillance. It still protects, but it also bears down lightly. It couldn't bear down more than the gravity toward which we let ourselves fall. And where would we fall if we fell a little more, if we were capable of becoming terribly guiltily heavy? Isn't that the question already, the weight that could precipitate us, make us tumble into an answer? The answer is that perhaps we would fall back into the calm from which one doesn't emerge except through lightness, because in it everything becomes infinitely light, too light to remain there. But aren't they afraid to say, to hear it said that they are dead? No, why would we be afraid? On the contrary, it's reassuring. That proves their insouciance, their boundless frivolity. But that's just what death is, being light. I ask myself why such dialogue seemed to hide a deep concern. Motionless thought, thought that wraps me around and perhaps protects me. Intractable thought that doesn't answer, that is simply there. You do not know who gave up. Grave, solitary thought in which the point is no doubt hidden. The extremely fine, amazingly distant point that keeps inviting me, without violence, but with a cold authority, to withdraw into forgetfulness. I want to talk to you, you who do not answer. I am allowed to. I will talk calmly, slowly, without interrupting myself. Even if I don't talk, even if I have no relation to the speech I am capable of uttering, why isn't everything over? Why can I question you? Why are you there like a space in which I am still lingering and with which I feel connected? You are not even silent, indifferent to everything, even to silence. And when I go toward you with a movement that surprises me, a cold, intimate, strange contact, as though I were supposed to, as though I couldn't, think of myself. Why do you let me believe that if I wanted you to, you could become visible? Why do you let me talk to you using intimate words that separate me from everyone else? Are you protecting me? Are you watching me? Why not discourage me? That would be easy, a sign, a firmer pressure, and I would be ready to say, all right, since you want me to, I'm giving it up. But you are simply there, and the words that go to you go to a wall that sends them back to me so that I can hear them. A wall, a real wall, four walls that form the boundaries of the place I live and make it a cell, an emptiness in the midst of everyone else. Why? What is this role I have to play? What is expected of me? Haven't I? Didn't I enter the calm? What was drawn out of me of that calm? Could the calm be destroyed? And yet if it is destroyed, do we continue to keep watch around it? That instant, that cold moment which we don't remember? And is it true that everyone is watching? Maybe only one, maybe no one. Maybe we aren't watching over anything. Maybe we're all still inside the calm, in that place where we come and go, ever tottering, ever more restless, and yet this is the breathing of profound repose. Calm, calm, what do you want from me? Yes, ask questions. The calm likes that. Why that word? Strange image. It says when a person enters this intimate calm at the moment of dying, at a time when peace and silence have found their place, that person, far from enjoying the calm for himself alone, hands it over to the common spirit by a mysterious gift, doesn't give it up, but hands it over freely. It couldn't be won, taken, or taken by surprise. In the last judgment is perhaps this pure gift through which, in the end, each person always rids himself of his moment of repose. But this calm which penetrates us, which yields us the truth that impels us, the moving force that unites us, this source that is fed by each person when he dies is, however, the thing we dare not call the eternal heart. Strange, strange thought. I look it in the face, but nothing disturbs it, nothing, therefore nothing forbids it, nothing requires it either. Within you, who envelop us and perhaps protect us, who are motionless, solitary, and grave, how light thoughts are, how they immediately rise, and all of them that are that way. They are all innocent, happy, joyful, the smile and salvation of a moment of emptiness. Nothing sweeter than such thoughts. They are free, they leave us free. To think them is to think nothing, and in this way we question on and on without end.